comes to Billboard as a service of WUSB Stony Brook, 90.1 FM. And this week, we're asking you to give generously to WUSB during Radiothon. Call 631-632-6901 and pledge now. Thank you.
And it's 2 minutes after 6 o'clock. You're listening to WUSB Stony Brook. Time once again for Off the Wall. Greetings from everybody. The program is Off the Wall. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Tuesday evening. As believe it or not, we launch into the autumn fundraiser here at WUSB. Yeah, I say believe it or not because it was a bit of a surprise. I think we were just told, oh, by the way, fundraising begins now, and we sort of had to jump to attention. But it's okay because we're always at attention, and we always have something really cool to bring to the folks here. And I think you, as a live listener to this radio program, will be delighted with something that we've come up with tonight, because it is a present just for you guys out there. I know a lot of people listen later on, and that's fine. And you can still donate to the radio station by going to WUSB.FM and navigating your way through all that, or just calling up 631-632-9872, 631-632-WUSB. I'm sure people will be taking pledges all month long. By month, I mean the one that hasn't even begun yet. We're getting a bit of an early start. But we have something that will be really amazing that I think people will be calling in droves. Hopefully they'll be calling in droves for. We'll get to that in just a moment. First, I want to welcome a special guest, Terrence. Welcome to Off the Wall.
Hi, and thanks.
I don't know if that microphone is working quite there. So move it over there like that. Try not to, too much. Now let's try it again. We have to test all the equipment.
Hello.
Much better, yeah. All right, you're here all the way here from Philadelphia.
Yes.
Awesome. You may recognize the voice of Terrence. He used to be known as Shapeshifter and appeared at several of our Hope conferences and was on the other radio show a few times as well. You did layout for 2600 magazine. Basically mixed it up in Philadelphia pretty well, I think, and changed history a bit.
Oh, thank you.
No, thank you, because that's really important. It's rather funny too, in a weird kind of a way, because if you've been following the history of our conferences and of the magazine and all that, you'll know that that Terrence was part of that whole RNC thing back in 2000. Can you believe that's 12 years ago that happened? You basically were one of four people that was rounded up as a ringleader of the RNC demonstrations in Philadelphia, and actually you were just on the telephone. I think I was even talking to you at the time when you were being surveyed by various law enforcement people, and they said that proved that you were coordinating all kinds of actions, and actually you were giving me directions on how to get to where things were going on, just basically, you know, peaceful marches and things like that. So you were thrown in jail for a week, and your face was plastered around the media as a really dangerous person. And what did they do? They tried to get you to accept that, to just sort of, they let you go, but then they just wanted you to, what was the initial deal they gave you?
Oh, they said 3 months probation and make a promise I wasn't going to do it again.
Wasn't going to do it again. And that didn't sit well with you, huh?
Oh, no.
No.
I appealed it and said, no way, we're going to trial.
Uh-huh. So they wanted to drop it. They wanted you to just admit to something. And not only that, you said let's bring it to trial. You did bring it to trial,
yes.
Which is more than I think most people would do. And you were victorious in trial, were you not?
The first one, the DA kind of, the judge I went in front of first, she felt like she had been too lenient towards the protesters and mm-hmm. wanted to throw a bone to the district attorney and decided that she was going to convict me on two minor charges. Which was disorderly conduct or conspiracy to disorderly conduct, and everything else was thrown out, which is kind of ironic, given that I had a $500,000 bail.
Yeah, that was another thing, $500,000 bail, which basically meant that's $500,000 you have to raise, I think, 10% of that in cash. Is that how it works?
Yes, in Philadelphia, that's how it works.
And we had to run around raising money to get you out because you were in a not very nice place for almost a week, right? Or was it more than a week?
Yeah, it was a week.
Uh-huh, and that's...
A week in Philadelphia jail system.
Yeah, and this was right after H2K, right after our 2000 conference, at which you had appeared at, and it was just pretty shocking to see how quickly things like that could happen to somebody. Okay, so she did that in the first...
Yeah, she convicted it, we appealed it, uh-huh. It went to a jury trial, and since it was $500,000 bail was for only misdemeanor charges... which is kind of ridiculous,
mm-hmm.
To say the least. They went to a jury trial, and in Philadelphia, they discourage you from asking for a jury trial.
Yeah, why is that?
Because they have so many trials coming through that they want to get things through the system as quickly as possible. So they'll give you the judge... They'll assign, if you ask for a jury trial right away, they'll assign you to the worst judge possible,
mm-hmm.
Who's almost guaranteed to, like, almost your. It'll be the most horrible experience you'll ever have going through the legal system if you ask for a jury trial. Instead, the tactics that some lawyers do is you'd say you ask for a bench trial, and then as soon as you get to the bench trial, you demand a jury trial.
Okay.
And then you get thrown into the general system, and that, and you have no idea who the judge is going to be, and that's better than taking the judge that they would assign you before.
The sure thing. Which
super conservative judge who's uh-huh. going to, you know, make demand that half your evidence doesn't get submitted.
So the tactic then is to go for a bench trial, and then right at the moment when the bench trial is about to begin, you demand a jury trial?
That's correct.
And that doesn't upset everybody that you
nope,
suddenly...
It's
okay.
It's a normal thing, but it's, you know, you have to have a decent lawyer to know that about this tactic. Otherwise...
Well, it doesn't take a decent lawyer to know that one fact. I know the fact now. I'm not even a lawyer at all.
Yes.
Wow. Well, okay, so now, but in your case, you had the bench trial, and then you appealed, and you were thrown into the jury pool. Is that how it worked? The judge pool,
yeah.
Whatever they call it.
There's a municipal court in Philadelphia for
uh-huh.
misdemeanors, and then uh-huh. it went to the Court of Common Pleas, which is where you normally would have got tried first.
Okay.
But since Philadelphia is special and has so many cases, they have a special thing to
Court of Common Pleas? It sounds kind of insulting. I mean, what's common about your...
It's Pennsylvania. It's
Commonwealth. Yeah, it's fine. It is pretty common, I suppose. Okay, yeah. So here you are. You're at the jury trial. What happened there?
The prosecution submitted their evidence, which was... which wasn't very much. They had only one person who claimed to have seen me the whole time. He wasn't from Philadelphia. He was observing the protests, as he was from Washington, D.C., and one is observing.
He was a cop, right, from Washington,
D.C.? He was a police officer from
Philadelphia. Cops weren't allowed to do this, so they got Washington, D.C. cops to do it instead. That was their brilliant tactic.
Yes. He was videotaping the whole protest, although... Amazingly, he tried to videograph me. He saw me, but when he tried to videograph me, this is how what he testified, is that the camera stopped working, or that I moved out of view. And so, evidently, I have unknown powers, and that I do not appear on videotape. Which is actually not true, because, and he said that I was in one location where a group of protesters, and this is the amazing thing. They were told 3 times by the police to get up and stop blocking the street, and then they did.
They got up and stopped blocking the street?
They got up and stopped. Then they went on to block some other street.
Okay.
But still, they were told to move, and they did.
And that was to confuse the cops. No
arrests were made at that location.
Okay.
But I was arrested because I was leading the protesters at that location. So even though that I didn't block any streets, they said, you know, that was their case. So flimsy as it is. I found a video of me from the Slob Project. Actually, they went on to do legal support of various other demonstrations afterwards, where they would send legal observers and have recordings and video evidence. And actually, after viewing many hours of that, we found a video of me at the same exact time as I was supposed to be in this other location, 1.5 miles in the opposite direction.
Wow. You do have powers.
Yes.
That must have scared the jury, so...
So, they presented that right before we, you know, and after they presented their evidence. And at first, you know, most people don't like to be on a jury trial. They don't like to have to come back the next day and sit through the trial and miss work. Which is a whole set of issues in itself, and so most people are pretty unhappy about being there. But after we showed that evidence and they took a lunch break, everybody came back smiling after lunch, and they were kind of laughing about the case and how flimsy it was.
Wow.
And then my lawyer made a motion to dismiss, which never gets granted at a jury trial.
But when there's a laughing jury coming back from lunch, I guess that's a good indication that...
I was pretty, you know, confident about my ability to, you know, not get convicted. And my lawyer made the motion to dismiss, which is very rare in jury trials, so that can be granted. And he said, you know what, I'm going to go ahead and grant it. It's like, I find the prosecution's evidence underwhelming, to say the least.
Nice. No, but what I'm wondering is, did you get to hear what the jury had to say? Did they get to say, we find the defendant, any of that?
No, it didn't even get to that point.
Why wouldn't you want it to get to that point? Since did you think that they might say something else?
No, it was that the judge was, my lawyer just figured, hey, we can just try it and see if it works. It did. The judge said, hey, I'm going to save everybody some time here. And he went and he made the agreement. And then all the jury people were like, that's great. We get to go home early.
But they would have gone home anyway, right, if they had said that they find the case without merit. They just didn't get to say anything.
It's true.
Yeah.
But
weird.
On the way out, most of the people in the jury said, you know, like, you know, shook my hand and said, oh, we're sorry you had to go through that.
Wow. That's awesome. But it wasn't over yet because, okay, you were found to be not guilty and all that, but they still wanted to keep your money, right? Didn't they want to keep, like, a percentage of it?
Yes, you get the 10% back except for about $1,000 for convenience of having you putting the money in.
Yeah, you're found not guilty, did nothing wrong, and yet they still want to keep your money, and that's insane. Now, I forget, was there a fight to get that back?
There was. We filed a civil suit, and we settled out of court.
Okay, good.
Mostly because the city had a $10 million insurance policy that covered civil rights violations.
that's, how do I get a policy like that so I can, like, abuse people's rights without even worrying about the consequences?
I'm sure there's an insurance underwriter for just about everything.
All right, so that is Terrence's remarkable story from the year 2000. And, of course, what really is ironic is that 4 years later I was going through something similar in New York City, just being on a sidewalk of a street where there happened to be a demonstration going by. The entire street was penned in, and everybody on it was dragged off to the pier and held. I was held for a couple of days. And charges were dropped pretty quickly, but the lawsuit that we have filed against the city has not been dropped, and that's still going on. 8 years later, we're still in that, and we'll see where that winds up. So it's been 12 years for you, 8 years for me. I don't think anybody I know got arrested in 2008, and the jury's still out in 2012. So, yeah, these conventions, they take a lot out of you, but for some reason, it seems to really hit us hard. And we're not even trying to be in the spotlights, but they seem to always find us. So yeah, okay, that was a bit of fun there. And we mentioned how conference, I believe you spoke at the 2004 conference about the RNC.
Yes.
A few days before I actually got swept up as well. And of course you spoke in 2000 as well before you knew you were going to get swept up. Didn't speak this year, did you? You weren't at Hope Number 9.
I was not. I didn't say that.
But here's something you might actually benefit from, as well as many of our listeners. We have all of the Hope Number 9 DVDs finished and ready. In fact, they've been people have been lining up for them. At the other radio station, we offered these DVDs, over 100 of them, I believe. A whole lot of them, and we offered those for a pledge of $150, every single one. It's less than a dollar a DVD, and we had to put a limit of 20 on there, and we got that, I think, in a half hour. They were all gone, and I said, we'd be insane to do this again, but I am making an exception tonight, because I know at this particular radio station, we don't have quite as many listeners, and of those listeners that we have, we don't have the huge majority that listen live. A lot of people listen later. So we can't make that offer for any time of day because we quickly go broke making all these DVDs. It takes time. It takes a few days to make a single set. That's how slow our robot is. But for those people listening now, yes, I will make the same offer. I will make the same offer just for this hour between 6 and 7 p.m. on September 25th, 2012. If you call 631-632-9872, a gentleman named Finn will answer the phone in the other room. There he is. You simply give us your name and all that information that he'll demand from you. And we will send you 100 DVDs, 100 or so. It's in that ballpark someplace. Every single talk at Hope Number 9, every single scheduled talk. $150 pledge, 631-632-9872. And again, you know, this is something, I think it sells for $400 normally, so it's a really good deal. It's something that was extremely popular I think it was about a month ago that we were offering these on WBAI. So if you find yourself listening right now, you are at an advantage because not many people know about this. Not many people will be able to take advantage of this opportunity. In fact, if you know any BAI listeners, you could probably sell it to them for more than what you pay for it, because that's how eager they were to get this package. So yeah, we sort of, if you're listening now, you're kind of part of an elite group that is not very big in number, but big in brains. And if you use those brains, you'll know that this is a very, very attractive proposition. 631-632-9872. Again, you know, the phones are open and we have people inside to answer them. And the point of us donating these DVDs to the station is to keep WUSB on the air, keep us strong, improve things around here because things do break down, as I often am complaining about. But we keep plodding along. That's the amazing thing about this place. Since 1977, this has been on the air as an FM station. In fact, Terrence, I was just mentioning to you when you walked in, I think this is your first time in the studio, that this board that I'm currently speaking through is older than you are. Isn't that so? And you've been through a lot, you know? So and the kids who come in here now from Stony Brook who go to school here, this is as old as their parents, I think. It's really old. But we keep things working. We keep things going because I mean, we got those street smarts. Okay, I see a call on the line. That's great. If there's a second call on the line, then Finn will have his hands full. And it's always fun to see that. You know, he basically spills things and jumps over the table and all kinds of a fun comedy like that. What I'm going to do to free up the phones a little bit so that we can answer phones as well if it comes down to it, I'm going to play an excerpt from Hope Number 9. This is good for you, Terrence, too, because you weren't there and you get to hear. You don't get to see it because we don't have a DVD player, but if you go for the package, you'll be able to see it, you'll be able to hear it, you'll be able to experience it. And this particular talk we're about to excerpt is one of our keynotes, William Binney. William Binney, the former NSA analyst who turned whistleblower and was subjected to all kinds of FBI raids and harassment of various sorts, because when you turn into a whistleblower, you make a lot of enemies. And he is basically letting people know that the National Security Agency has turned its attention to citizens of the United States, that we are no longer immune from the surveillance that they take part in, all the new technology that they're experimenting with. Yeah, they can now use that against American citizens, and they are using it against American citizens. They are building this huge, huge facility in Utah for all kinds of storage of electronic communication. It is scary. This is X-Files stuff here that they're doing. If someone like William Binney was not around to tell us, we would never know about these things. So let's listen for a few minutes to just one of the 100 or so talks that you will get for pledging $150 to 631-632-9872 between now and 7 o'clock. This is William Binney, who spoke at the Hope Conference only a couple of months ago.
That's just been found, of course, unconstitutional, which it is. And everything they're doing is unconstitutional. That's why they're trying to keep the EFF lawsuit out of the Supreme Court, because at that point they're afraid it'll be ruled unconstitutional and their whole house of cards will fall. That's really what's driving them. But at any rate, after that and all the stuff we were doing, they decided to raid us to keep us quiet, threaten us, you know. So we were raided simultaneously, four of us. We did sign the complaint to the DOD IG's office about all the corruption in NSA and about all this feeding. I mean, they provided a hotline that said, if you see waste, fraud, and abuse, you're supposed to report it here. This is government policy. So I said, okay, well, let's do it. So we did. And, of course, they sent the FBI to visit us. In my case, they came in with guns drawn. I don't know why they did that, but they did, so. Like I said before, I've been shot at. Mostly, I haven't told anybody, but most of the time that I was shot at was by deer hunters when I was out hunting in Pennsylvania woods. And the guys coming down were from New York. I mean, they would shoot at anything. And I would hear these bullets come on by my head, you know. Let me get out of here. I didn't shoot back because I wouldn't miss, you know. So anyway, after we got raided, they came in and took our computers and everything, and then over time they wanted to keep us continually quiet. This raid, by the way, happened the day after the second morning after Attorney General Gonzalez's testimony to the Senate Judiciary Committee, where he was testifying to these surveillance programs and what he referred to as the TSP, Terrorist Surveillance Program, which was a bunch of programs. And the one that we were talking about, spying on Americans, everybody in this country, was called Stellar Wind, and he never addressed that one at all. So they were afraid that we would go to that committee and tell them what he never told them. So they wanted to keep us quiet in that way, too. That was why they raided us right after his testimony, because they realized that we had a history of visiting committees, you know, and, well, since we knew what the program was all about, we would probably take a shot at the Judiciary Committee, since none of the other committees were paying any attention. So, anyhow, that was an experience, but It didn't, I mean, after, I didn't, it didn't scare me. What it did was make me mad. All right. I was getting mad while they were still there. In fact, I got so mad I accused them of being sent there by somebody else, and that, you know, and then I said, the reason you're really here is if you want me to keep quiet about Stellar Wind, and here's what this program does, spying on all Americans, taking all the data in, and I'm explaining this to them on my back porch. And I'm doing it, the head agent there, Special Agent Paul Marek, who signed the affidavit with a bunch of lies to get the judge to sign it, little did the judge know, right? And we're dealing with that. Being quiet is not one thing I'm going to do, by the way. I will not sit here and acquiesce to this. Well, and I'm not alone, so I you need to know that. There are other people who are with me. There are like five of us who came with that. And then we ran into people who downtown in Washington, Gap and the EFF and the ACLU, and we're dealing with, and we're cooperating with all of them, trying to help them too. So so we aren't alone. There's a large community out there, which we didn't know at the time because we, I mean, I was a back room guy from NSA who broke codes. You know, I came out and, gee, what's the world really about out here, you know? So this is all new to me. It took me a while to figure this out, but I wasn't going to sit by and let the FBI do what they were doing. So I accused them of many things at my house when they'd been. Before they left, they had to have a meeting outside my house because none of the other – see, I caused them a problem when I exposed this highly classified program to all these agents who weren't cleared, okay? So they have a problem now. And the head agent was the only one who was cleared. Now, you know, he took an oath to defend the Constitution, too. But he wasn't living up to his oath. And I, as I've said before, neither are any people in Congress or anybody in the administration. They're all violating our constitutional rights. So that's why I'm standing up and saying these things, because I just can't let it pass. I mean, these people are basically cowards. I mean, this guy, when I was explaining this to all these other agents, the only thing he could do was look at the floor. I mean, I watched the body language, everything, you know. I read more into body language than anything else, so it was pretty clear to me that he was ashamed of what he was doing, but he was still doing it. And I told him the Nuremberg, you know, defense doesn't work. Following orders is not, you know, not acceptable. So then after that, I decided, well, I mean, we lawyered up right after that raid so that, and our lawyers are sitting there, you have to be quiet, don't say anything, you know, they'll use it against you and stuff like that. You know, and so he was really a strong advocate, and he was an ex-prosecutor, so he was a strong advocate of saying nothing, so that you didn't give ammunition to the prosecution. Well, there wasn't any ammunition to give him, except the stuff I would talk about would be things they'd have to drag me into court for and charge me with would be exposing the crimes they were committing. Right, so I thought that would be a good idea. Let them do that. So, at any rate. That was up until 2010. Then in 2010, they decided that, they threatened us with, they made one last threat for prosecution against us. It had to do with our Turf Valley Club meeting. And at the Turf Valley Club, we had all the people who they were interested in met. What we were trying to do was to address how to solve and how to approach the solution of Medicare, Medicaid fraud. And the FBI, after their raid, they raided us shortly after that, and that was, and they had that. What that gave them was all the. I mean, of course, not that they already didn't have all the emails and everything we were sending back and forth, but in email we listed the agenda of what we were going to discuss and a cooperation paper and all that, which we took off the web, by the way. They called it a conspiracy paper, which was taken directly off the web. So I guess the web is a conspiracy center or something. But at any rate, They were planning on doing that, and so I and our lawyer told that they were planning on indicting us on that Turk Valley Club meeting, and I figured they had all the evidence. Why are they doing that? You know, I said, well, it's a malicious prosecution is the charge. Okay, so I figured this is when I explained it's on Democracy Now. I said, well, I know Tom Drake's phone is tapped, okay, because he's been indicted already. So I'm going to call Tom and tell him all the evidence that we have about malicious prosecution that they're trying to get against us on this Turk Valley Club meeting. So I called up Tom and I listed all this stuff, you know. And I figured the FBI couldn't find the data, so I said, well, when you go into the file, you know, you click on the file and you go down to properties, you know, and you, so I had to explain it over the phone to Tom. Tom didn't say anything. I think he understood what I was doing, but... So after that happened, though, we never heard about the Turf Valley Club again. So then the DOJ decides they're going to offer us letters of immunity. That was Kirk Wiebe and I. So they offered us letters of immunity under the condition that that we would be honest and tell them everything that we discussed at lunches with Tom Drake. Because we had lunches with Tom after he got raided, too, because we were friends, you know. And just because somebody gets raided by the FBI doesn't make them a non-friend, you know. So we weren't going to throw them away just because of that. So our lawyer kept, I will tell you what I told our lawyer. He said, they want to talk to you, and so they'll give you letters of immunity. And I said, you tell those bastards to go piss up a rope. And he said, no, here's a way to, this is, you know, he finally convinced me. He said, well, you know, if you do this, you're off the hook and it's all done with and they will never come back. And so I said, okay, so I couldn't pass up the opportunity, you know, because when I went to meet these guys, one was the prosecutor, Welsh, who was the same prosecutor in the Senator Stevens case. He's also the prosecutor in Tom's case. And he was also, he came in and took over from another prosecutor, who was threatening to indict us on that Turk Valley's thing. So he was there, and then an FBI person was there, a woman, and then a man who, he tried to stay. He was with the FBI, but I knew he was from Q2 from NSA, you know. So the three of them were there, and I started off saying, you know, because I wanted to make it clear how I felt about them. I said, you people do not know how pissed off at you I really am. You know, and then we got into asking questions, and I would answer their questions, and I said, and then I got into saying random things like, you know, I was really irritated at all the laws that NSA was breaking, you know, and this idiot on the end from Q2 said, what laws are those? Well, you know, that was my opening. You know, I just had to lay them all out, including the Constitution. And all he could do at the end of that was look at the prosecutor, and none of them could say a word. That's why I say they're all cowards. Sunlight is the solution to these things. And so that's why I'm trying to do that. Thanks.
All right. Well, that was an excerpt from Hope Number 9, which took place in July here in New York City, or there in New York City, close by. And that was William Binney, the NSA operative turned whistleblower that was our keynote speaker. And boy, what an amazing talk that was. That alone, I think, is worth a $150 pledge. But you get that plus about 99 other talks, all of which are extremely interesting, just by calling 631-632-9872. And pledging $150. It is a steal. And we want to thank Michael from Brookhaven who called in and took advantage of this. Very smart guy out there in Brookhaven.
Well, they're smart in Brookhaven, you know.
That voice is the voice of Finn.
That's right.
Speaking before I introduced him.
And there's...
Let me move the microphone closer.
Many other towns out there where there's some smart people, and they should be calling right now. Mm-hmm. 632-9872. That's 631-632-WU. USB. Get yourself, how many DVDs is this, Emmanuel?
It's around 100, it might be 101, it might be 99, it's in that ballpark.
You're doing so many, you don't even know how many.
I think it's over 100, I'm pretty sure it is.
100 DVDs.
Yeah, and we're going to start Michael's tonight, we're going to start making that job. It's going to take a while, it's going to take a few days. But
wow.
We're going to get that to the station, and they'll send it out to him. And the same thing could happen to you if you call 631-632-9872 and pledge $150. You'll get, I think it's the most amazing conference that took place this year on any of these subjects. And just to give you an idea of some of the things being talked about, subjects such as how to communicate with your car's network, ways to hack into an automobile and bypass all the controls that are going on, historic hacks in portable computing, hacktivism tools in the Arab Spring, how to hack the law, hacker spaces, hacking the cosmos via crowdsourced particle astronomy. I won't even pretend to know what that's all about. Hacking mindsets, conceptual approaches to transmission art, improvisation, circuit bending, and gaming technology. Geeks and Depression, a very interesting panel talking about how people in the hacker world have been confronted with and have dealt with depression and various other things. Explosive steganography, the emergence of hackers as artists, artists as hackers. It just goes, there's even a talk here about how DUI and DWI testing works and how you can understand the technology involved behind it. It's kind of controversial. We don't want it to be seen as a way to defeat the system if you're guilty of something like that, but it is important to understand how technology works. This is the kind of thing we talk about at hacker conferences. There are all kinds of legal people there, all kinds of people from Anonymous and young, old, you name it. There are folks from Cryptome who basically leak all kinds of information, have been doing so for a very, very long time and have all kinds of really controversial stuff out there. Talk on combat robots. yeah, don't ask. Building radios to talk to the dead. That is a very interesting talk right there. It's all about how ghost hunters use electronic tools to find patterns in the environment around us and exploit them as a way to communicate with spirits of the deceased. Now,
okay.
It's not a psycho giving the talk or anything like that. It's basically focusing on things that are actually being peddled out there and kind of giving examples of how that sort of thing is used. Very interesting. I got some very good reports from that talk. There's a talk on brain chemistry, how psychoactive chemicals hack the central nervous system. There's a talk on autism and the large amount of people in the hacker community who are artistic. Autistic too. All of that and more, about 100 talks. It was a fascinating conference. It was amazing. I think you were there for a couple of talks, right?
I was there, yeah, and it was quite amazing. And I have to tell you that if you were there, that's fantastic. You caught as much as you could, but you couldn't have caught all of it.
No way.
Because so many things are happening simultaneously. Just amazing amount of time doing all these things. And I don't think you can really say explosive steganography on the air at this time of day.
Well, I did, and it's done, and now we must pay for it.
Okay.
And you can help us do that by calling 631-632-9872, getting this incredible package, which, again, is only being offered until 7 o'clock. For $150, you'll get all of the scheduled talks that took place at Hope No. 9 Conference in New York City back in July. And that's about 100 DVDs. Believe me, you'll find it interesting, and you'll have a lot of material to watch for quite some time.
And this way you show your support right here on WUSB for Off the Wall, as well as the station itself.
Yes.
This is one of the few truly independent voices in the world. We answer to no board of directors, no stockholders, no corporations.
Yeah, they come by and try to get us to answer, and we don't. We will not answer to them.
That is correct. And they can't get these DVDs, I don't think, for under $400. And you have them right now for $150. 100 or so DVDs for $150. The entire Hope 9 conference. It's a wonderful thing. You know you want it.
Mm-hmm.
631.
632.
WUSB.
And if you don't want it, and you know somebody who does, you can always give it to them. But I don't know anybody who doesn't want this because, a lot of people didn't make it to the conference, and those people who did, as you said, couldn't possibly have seen everything. There is so much. I mean, I'm going through older sets of Hope conferences because we're getting them all up on YouTube and on Blip TV. In fact, if you go to YouTube, we now have Channel 2600, which is pretty cool. But I've been looking at those old talks, things from 2002. Mm-hmm. I was talking to Terrence a little while earlier about older talks that were given. They are still interesting. They age well. They're fascinating to listen to and watch as sort of a time capsule. But also, you learn things about today, about technology, how things have developed, where things are going, what we anticipated back then. So these are real historical bits of information that will last a lifetime, I think. And, of course, they have no DRM in them. You can copy them as much as you want. And, Finn has to run to answer the phone. Thank you very much to that person calling in, 631-632-9872. If another person calls in, then I'm going to go to an excerpt, and I'll run in and answer the phone. How's that? Yeah, that'll be fun. And then Terrence will be right after me if a third person calls in. 631-632-9872. Do you regret missing the conference now, Terrence?
I certainly do.
Yeah. Well, see, that doesn't happen again. In 2014, we'll be doing this. We don't know what it's going to be called yet, but we'll be doing another conference because there is so much support out there for people to attend these things and make them better every single time. I want to play another excerpt. This is actually from a distinguished speaker known as Eben Moglen. He gave a talk on how to retrofit the first laws of robotics. Yeah, the first law of robotics. We live with robots now, as we always knew we would, but they have no hands or feet. We carry them in our pockets. They see what we see. They hear what we hear. They always know where we are, but they do not work for us, and they are not programmed to obey the first law. Profit made them. Profit runs them, and they hurt us every day. Free software can retrofit the first law of robotics into the robots we call cell phones, but those who control the robots don't want freedom inside. And that's where we come in. And this talk discusses how. Let's take a listen. 631-632-9872. Pledge $150. You'll get all 100 or so talks. 631-632-9872. Let's listen to a little bit of the retrofitting the first law of robotics.
But what we have to do, beyond all the stuff we're good at, is to do the thing that human beings haven't been good at so far. We have to be really alive to the danger, and we have to teach people that safety must be put in now, after we've already launched the boat. Well, okay. Preaching is part of it. But preaching is effective where there's adequate dogma, that is to say, where we really understand the doctrine of what we're preaching. And so we have a little intellectual heavy lifting to do. What does it really mean to talk about hurting people? What does it really mean to talk about not hurting people or guaranteeing non-hurt to people in this complex environment in which, one, the robot's cognition has to be reduced to the level of our desire. It should not be listening to me when I didn't tell it to. It shouldn't be informing people of my location when I haven't said it can, and so on. But where that dialogue cannot possibly consist of punching OK or no on dialogue boxes on something every tenth of a second through a lifetime. We need to understand what services can be safely offered and which ones can't, or rather, how service design itself must be altered in order to produce safety for users. Location-directed or location-aware or location-based services are terribly important and terribly dangerous. And the primary problem is the real-time ascertainment of the location of human beings by those with power. It does very little good, in other words, to describe regulatory approaches to such services, because the regulatory approach will always be engineered by government to say, you shouldn't do this unless you're us, or you shouldn't do this unless we want you to. Or you shouldn't do this unless there's a court order or other authoritative communication telling you to start turning over real-time location data about human beings. The very senior U.S. government official who told me back in March, well, we've learned now that we need to have a robust social graph of the United States, is reflecting the learning of all the governments on Earth in the last 14 months, when with great suddenness they all discovered that what they wanted was a robust social graph of their societies. You understand, of course, that we could put this in plain English for the people around us. We could say, this means the United States government intends to keep a list of everybody every American knows. That's not what we used to quaintly refer to as a free society. In fact, that's what I would call a dangerous neighborhood. And in that dangerous neighborhood, which it may not be possible to prevent ourselves from living in unless we learn how to exercise democracy really effectively about this, which is going to mean a lot of preaching and a lot of teaching. But in that very dangerous neighborhood, we have to understand that things that inform at headquarters where we are serious problems. I must admit that I find it kind of reassuring how naively confident Americans are. As I grew up to manhood and I started traveling around the world, I discovered that in most of, indeed all of the societies I went to, except my own, people didn't really think that what they said on the telephone was private. And my friends in the Soviet Union were particularly aware of this, of course. I was, too, when I lived there briefly in the late 70s. What seems to me so amazing is that it is possible to sell people a thing and say, oh, you've got a personal assistant inside this object, and you can talk to her, of course, in English, and say whatever you want, and we'll take it back to some warehouse data center somewhere, and then we'll send you an answer and tell you what to do. If the KGB had tried this, it would not have worked.
Just one of many talks here that we're offering tonight from the Hope Number 9 conference. But time's running out. We only have 12 minutes left in the program. Join the people who have called in so far, 631-632-9872, and get every single talk that was scheduled during the Hope Number 9 conference in New York City. Boy, do we have such amazing things. Did I mention the Yes Men also gave a keynote address, and that's included with this? Or that Steve Rambam gave another amazing long talk on privacy and how it's ever so fleeting these days, how so much is known about you that you don't know is out there. Or Robert Steele's spy marathon talks, where he basically talks about the U.S. government and intelligence and all kinds of other things like that. And so many more talks, the social engineering panel and the ACLU talk on WikiLeaks and whistleblowers, why browser cryptography is bad, how we can make it better, all kinds of things. I can go on for an hour just listing the talks that are included in this particular collection that we're offering here tonight. But the easiest thing is to simply give out the phone number. And hope there are people out there listening right now live, whether you're local or whether you're in the in the stratosphere of the internet somewhere in the world. Our phone number is 631-632-9872, country code 1 if you're outside the U.S. Yes, we take donations from all over the place. $150 gets you all of the DVDs from Hope Number 9. It is less than half. It's less than a third of what it costs, right? Yeah, well, no, maybe it's a little more than a third. Okay, but it's less than half, that's for sure. Math is not my strong thing. 631-632-9872. It goes for, I think, $400 online if you buy the full set. And people do buy the full sets, so it's not like that's an obscenely high price. That is, for 100 DVDs, that's a pretty good price. But we're offering a real cut rate tonight for those of you who listen to Off the Wall Live, because... Well, you make the show what it is when you call in and communicate back and forth. It's something we've been doing since 2003 and something we hope to continue doing. But again, we need for the station to be here in order for that to happen, and that's where we all come in. 631-632-9872. We're making this donation to the station of all the DVDs because we believe in the station and we want that to be able to continue as well. If the DVDs are not what you have in mind, there are all kinds of other things that we are offering as well for different different amounts. Just give a call to 631-632-9872, and you can find out from our telephone volunteer inside just what that might be. I want to play something else. I want to play another excerpt in the few moments we have left. And this comes from one of the many back-and-forth debates that took place at the conference that are also included in this package. This has to do with DARPA funding of hacker-related projects and how that's becoming increasingly a problem in the hacker world. Do you accept money from the Defense Department? Does that subvert what it is that you're trying to do? Is it something that you should walk away from? Is it something you should take advantage of? All kinds of thoughts and feelings on this. And this was, I believe, a 90-minute panel that that we presented. Again, it comes along with 99 other talks. If you call now, 631-632-9872, pledge $150. We take all kinds of credit cards and all sorts of other ways of payment as well. It's really a good deal and something that I think we all should share in and learn from. 631-632-9872. Let's take a listen to another excerpt from Hope Number 9.
One of the reasons I think we're even having this debate is because all of the other organizations that used to be able to get grants from and support from have been stripped of everything. And that's a cultural issue. That's a cultural issue of people not being willing to pay taxes or not seeing that as a way of making that happen. And we've been silent that entire time. At the last panel, there was someone talking about how hackerspaces are intrinsically political and how we don't see them that way in America. And I think that's because we haven't been paying attention. We absolutely need to.
It seems to me that as long as you're not going after the money, you could actually use this way, use getting funding as a method of subverting things, because you already want to build these classrooms and spread this education, and if DARPA's funding it, that means they now can't put those funds towards making bullets that explode in midair so they do more damage. And if someone wants to send recruiters to that, well, they probably already have those recruiters, and now they can't send them somewhere else, and now they have to share a space with someone who's going to be trying to instill more ethics and someone who's going to try and mitigate that, which decreases their effectiveness. So could that be making more ethical?
Everyone here has thought of this, and it's unfortunately not as easy as all that, but I won't say my opinion. So,
I would say I'd love to see a soldier building a house rather than, you know, blowing it up any given day of the week, and I think that's true of most people.
Yeah. So, yes, I totally agree with you, but I also agree with the concerns that Mitch has expressed, and that then those funds are tainted, and then the community or the group giving those funds is seen as legitimized.
And also, they have a budget this year of $3.2 billion, and it can be increased in a second.
I would like to point out that the TSA budget's about 20. Well, it's actually about 40 billion. NASA budget's about 20.
And I think that the Audre Lorde quote is a good one to remember. The master's tools will never dismantle a master's house. I think you always want to be very, very careful that precisely put some serious thought into exactly what the end goals are and what this can lead to, no matter what benefits you might see at the time.
I think that's an excellent point, and that's what we're going to do.
We have time for more questions?
Just one more.
Okay, so this is the last question.
So on education, you know, I totally agree that classrooms need more soldering irons and CNC machines and, you know, et cetera. And what I'm kind of worried about is that a lot of the kids today are going to get, you know, these great, you know, engineering problem-solving skills, but not critical thinking skills. And what are your response to that or ideas of how that applies?
Totally take this one. Okay. Oh, man. Okay. So the last few years I've been a part of something called School Factory and Space Federation. We care about hackerspaces becoming the schools of the future. You might be able to tell from some of the things that I said earlier. Even just putting shop classes back in schools is not going to solve the problem. Because you used a drill press does not mean you suddenly have the ability to even build a chair. So for me, it's awesome because suddenly people have access to tools and equipment and hopefully say, oh, wow, and this other person came in from, apparently they do this outside of school, and I kind of don't like being in school, so I'll go hang out there instead.
I care about corrupting them and pulling them out of that system, because the education system is just as broken as our military system, perhaps more dangerously so, actually. Yes. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I'm just happy to hear whatever thoughts are out there.
Okay. For the most part, I'd like to just say I think that's absolutely true. More kids need to be brought up in a stronger STEM environment, but I think that the real problem there is you have to reach out to the parents as well, and I think hackerspaces and communities are the ways to do that. So I think DARPA was right in getting hackerspaces involved. It's a person-to-person thing.
Yeah, I think we should definitely instill critical thinking in the educational programs.
Yes, please, please come and invade the library. If you have 5 minutes during the week, we have space. We sometimes have money, allegedly. And if, you know, we are basically all about critical thinking. And really, if you want a truly neutral space to do hacker stuff, the library's pretty much it. If you want to,
yeah. Did you hear about what they did in Texas? Like, you can't even bring up critical thinking in any class because it might undermine the beliefs that the parents are trying to instill in their children.
Well, the
it's awful.
The problems with the education system are many and huge and perhaps insurmountable, and this is one of the great reasons why hackerspaces are flourishing in our country, because it fills some of that horrible void. So I hope this panel has been informative for people in seeing that these issues really are important to think through, because this affects the future of us individually and collectively as a community and the whole hackerspace movement. So, and there's no rights and wrongs. So please keep talking about this, and let's see where we are in a few years as a result of the thinking and talking and discussion in our community in the future.
All right, now is our last piece from Hope Number 9, which we're offering tonight. That was a discussion on DARPA funding. That was Mitch Altman losing his voice amongst other people. Please call, join the people who have called in so far this hour, 631-632-9872, and get the full set for $150 of all the Hope Number 9 talks. And if you're listening later and you really want this collection, email us, otw@2600.com, and maybe we can do it again in the future, but you got to let us know. Terrence, thank you so much for coming by, and wish you the best of luck.
Thanks for having me.
All right, we'll see you again next week. Good night.
Standing there alone, the ship is waiting, all systems are go. Are you sure? Control is not convinced, but the computer has the evidence. No need to report. The countdown starts. Watching in the trance, the crew is certain, nothing left to chance. All is working, trying to relax. Up in the capsule, summing up the drink. Jokes made your tone. The count goes on. Beneath the ship.